Chapter 20. The skipper of the Sephora had a thin red whisker all round his face, and the sort of complexion that goes with hair of that color, also the particular, rather smeary shade of blue in the eyes. He was not exactly a showy figure. His shoulders were high, his stature but middling, one leg slightly more bandy than the other. He shook hands, looking vaguely around. A spiritless tenacity was his main characteristic, I judged. I behaved with a politeness which seemed to disconcert him. Perhaps he was shy. He mumbled to me, as if he were ashamed of what he was saying, gave his name, it was something like Archbold, but at this distance of years I hardly am sure, his ship's name, and a few other particulars of that sort, in the manner of a criminal making a reluctant and doleful confession. He had had terrible weather on the passage out, terrible, terrible wife aboard too. By this time we were seated in the cabin, and the steward brought in a tray with a bottle and glasses. Hanks. No. Never took liquor. Would have some water, though. He drank two tumblerfuls. Terrible thirsty work. Ever since daylight had been exploring the islands round his ship. What was that for fun? I asked, with an appearance of polite interest. No. He sighed. Painful duty. As he persisted in his mumbling and I wanted my double to hear every word, I hit upon the notion of informing him that I regretted to say I was hard of hearing. Such a young man too, he nodded, keeping his smeary blue, unintelligent eyes fastened upon me. What was the cause of it, some disease, he inquired, without the least sympathy, and as if he thought that, if so, I'd got no more than I deserved. Yes, disease, I admitted in a cheerful tone which seemed to shock him. But my point was gained, because he had to raise his voice, to give me his tale. It is not worth while to record that version. It was just over 2 months since all this had happened, and he had thought so much about it that he seemed completely muddled as to its bearings, but still immensely impressed. What would you think of such a thing happening on board your own ship? I've had the Sephora for these 15 years. I am a well-known shipmaster. He was densely distressed, and perhaps I should have sympathized with him if I had been able to detach my mental vision from the unsuspected sharer of my cabin, as though he were my second self. There he was on the other side of the bulkhead, 4 or 5 feet from us, no more, as we sat in the saloon. I looked politely at Captain Archbold, if that was his name, but it was the other I saw, in a gray sleeping suit, seated on a low stool, his bare feet close together, his arms folded, and every word said between us falling into the ears of his dark head bowed on his chest. I have been at sea now, man and boy, for 37 years, and I've never heard of such a thing happening in an English ship. And that it should be my ship. Wife on board too. I was hardly listening to him. Don't you think, I said, that the heavy sea which, you told me, came aboard just then might have killed the man? I have seen the sheer weight of a sea kill a man very neatly, by simply breaking his neck. Good God, he uttered, impressively, fixing his smeary blue eyes on me. He see. No man killed by the sea ever looked like that. He seemed positively scandalized at my suggestion. And as I gazed at him, certainly not prepared for anything original on his part, he advanced his head close to mine, and thrust his tongue out at me so suddenly that I couldn't help starting back. After scoring over my calmness in this graphic way, he nodded wisely. If I had seen the sight, he assured me, I would never forget it, as long as I lived. The weather was too bad to give the corpse a proper sea burial. So next day at dawn they took it up on the poop, covering its face with a bit of bunting. He read a short prayer, and then, just as it was, in its oilskins and long boots, they launched it amongst those mountainous seas that seemed ready every moment to swallow up the ship herself and the terrified lives on board of her. That reefed foresail saved you, I threw in. Under God it did, he exclaimed fervently. It was by a special mercy, I firmly believe, that it stood some of those hurricane squalls. It was the setting of that sail which I began. God's own hand in it, he interrupted me. Odin less could have done it. I don't mind telling you that I hardly dare give the order. It seemed impossible that we could touch anything without losing it, and then our last hope would have been gone. The terror of that gale was on him yet. I let him go on for a bit, then said, casually as if returning to a minor subject. You were very anxious to give up your mate to the shore people, I believe? He was. To the law. His obscure tenacity on that point had in it something incomprehensible, and a little awful, something, as it were, mystical, quite apart from his anxiety that he should not be suspected of countenancing any doings of that sort. 37 virtuous years at sea, of which over 20 of immaculate command, and the last 15 in the Sephora, seemed to have laid him under some pitiless obligation. And you know, he went on, groping shamefacedly amongst his feelings, I did not engage that young fellow. His people had some interest with my owners. I was in a way forced to take him on. He looked very smart, very gentlemanly, and all that. But do you know I never liked him, somehow. I am a plain man. You see, he wasn't exactly the sort for the chief mate of a ship like the Sephora. I had become so connected in thoughts and impressions with the secret sharer of my cabin that I felt as if I, personally, were being given to understand that I too was not the sort that would have done for the chief mate of a ship like the Sephora. I had no doubt of it in my mind. Not at all the style of man. You understand, he insisted, superfluously, looking hard at me. I smiled urbanely. He seemed at a loss for a while. I suppose I must report a suicide. Beg pardon? Suicide. That's what I'll have to write to my owners directly I get in. Unless you manage to recover him before tomorrow, I assented, dispassionately. Alive. He mumbled something which I really did not catch, and I turned my ear to him in a puzzled manner. He fairly bawled. The land, I say, the mainland is at least 7 miles off my anchorage. About that. My lack of excitement, of curiosity, of surprise, of any sort of pronounced interest, began to arouse his distrust. But except for the felicitous pretense of deafness, I had not tried to pretend anything. I had felt utterly incapable of playing the part of ignorance properly, and therefore was afraid to try. It is also certain that he had brought some ready-made suspicions with him, and that he viewed my politeness as a strange and unnatural phenomenon. And yet how else could I have received him? Not heartily. That was impossible for psychological reasons, which I need not state here. My only object was to keep off his inquiries. Surly? Yes, but surliness might have provoked a point-blank question. From its novelty to him, and from its nature, punctilious courtesy was the manner best calculated to restrain the man. But there was the danger of his breaking through my defense bluntly. I could not, I think, have met him by a direct lie, also for psychological, not moral, reasons. If he had only known how afraid I was of his putting my feeling of identity with the other to the test. But, strangely enough, I thought of it only afterward, I believe, that he was not a little disconcerted by the reverse side of that weird situation, by something in me that reminded him of the man he was seeking suggested a mysterious similitude to the young fellow he had distrusted and disliked from the first. However that might have been, the silence was not very prolonged. He took another oblique step. I reckon I had no more than a 2-mile pull to your ship. Not a bit more. And quite enough to, in this awful heat, I said. Another pause full of mistrust followed. Necessity, they say, is mother of invention, but fear too, is not barren of ingenious suggestions. And I was afraid he would ask me point blank for news of my other self. Nice little saloon, isn't it? I remarked, as if noticing for the first time the way his eyes roamed from one closed door to the other. And he very well fitted out too. Here, for instance, I continued, reaching over the back of my seat negligently, and flinging the door open, is my bathroom. He made an eager movement, but hardly gave it a glance. I got up, shut the door of the bathroom, and invited him to have a look round, as if I were very proud of my accommodation. He had to rise, and be shown round, but he went through the business without any raptures whatever. And now we'll have a look at my stateroom, I declared, in a voice as loud as I dared to make it, crossing the cabin to the starboard side with purposely heavy steps. He followed me in and gazed around. My intelligent double had vanished. I played my part. Very convenient, isn't it? Very nice. Very comf. He didn't finish, and went out brusquely, as if to escape from some unrighteous wiles of mine. But it was not to be. I had been too frightened not to feel vengeful. I felt I had him on the run, and I meant to keep him on the run. My polite insistence must have had something menacing in it, because he gave in suddenly. And I did not let him off a single item. Mate's room, pantry, storerooms, the very sail locker which was also under the poop, he had to look into them all. When at last I showed him out on the quarter deck, he drew a long, spiritless sigh, and mumbled dismally that he must really be going back to his ship now. I desired my mate, who had joined us, to see to the captain's boat. The man of whiskers gave a blast on the whistle which he used to wear hanging round his neck, and yelled, "Sephora's away!" My double down there in my cabin must have heard, and certainly could not feel more relieved than one. Four fellows came running out from somewhere forward, and went over the side, while my own men, appearing on deck two, lined the rail. I escorted my visitor to the gangway ceremoniously, and nearly overdid it. He was a tenacious beast. On the very ladder he lingered, and in that unique, guiltily conscientious manner of sticking to the point. I say, you don't think that I covered his voice loudly. Certainly not. I am delighted. Goodbye. I had an idea of what he meant to say, and just saved myself by the privilege of defective hearing. He was too shaken generally to insist, but my mate, close witness of that parting, looked mystified and his face took on a thoughtful cast. As I did not want to appear as if I wished to avoid all communication with my officers, he had the opportunity to address me. Seems a very nice man. His boat's crew told our chaps a very extraordinary story, if what I am told by the steward is true. I suppose you had it from the captain, sir? Yes. I had a story from the captain. A very horrible affair, isn't it, sir? It is. Beats all these tales we hear about murders in Yankee ships. I don't think it beats them. I don't think it resembles them in the least. Bless my soul, you don't say so. But of course I've no acquaintance whatever with American ships, not I, so I couldn't go against your knowledge. It's horrible enough for me. But the queerest part is that those fellows seemed to have some idea the man was hidden aboard here. They had really. Did you ever hear of such a thing? Preposterous, isn't it? We were walking to and fro athwart the quarterdeck. No one of the crew forward could be seen. The day was Sunday, and the mate pursued. There was some little dispute about it. Our chaps took offense. As if we would harbor a thing like that, apostrophe, they said. Wouldn't you like to look for him in our coal hole? Apostrophe, quite a tiff. But they made it up in the end. I suppose he did drown himself. Don't you, sir? I don't suppose anything. You have no doubt in the matter, sir? None whatever. I left him suddenly. I felt I was producing a bad impression, but with my double down there it was most trying to be on deck. And it was almost as trying to be below. Altogether a nerve-trying situation. But on the whole I felt less torn in two when I was with him. There was no one in the whole ship whom I dared take into my confidence. Since the hands had got to know his story, it would have been impossible to pass him off for anyone else, and an accidental discovery was to be dreaded now more than ever. The steward being engaged in laying the table for dinner, we could talk only with our eyes when I first went down. Later in the afternoon we had a cautious try at whispering. The Sunday quietness of the ship was against us. The stillness of air and water around her was against us. The elements, the men were against us. Everything was against us in our secret partnership. Time itself for this could not go on forever. The very trust in Providence was, I suppose, denied to his guilt. Shall I confess? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.